footpath. The shade became so deep that it no longer felt like afternoon, but twilight. The eerie sensation of being watched lingered. She glanced back, feeling she wasn't alone, and the frantic chatter of the woodland creatures seemed to confirm it. Nevertheless, she persisted. After a long walk, she discovered a huge oak. Its limbs were so heavy and twisted they rested on the ground. The behemoth was taller than the abbey itself, and she remembered seeing it from above while practicing her piloting skills with Aunt Juliana. What had they called it? The Sentinel Oak? She had traveled much farther from the abbey than she'd realized. A strange feeling swarmed her. Then, one by one, the noises of the forest began to hush until they were utterly silent. Not a bird sounded. Not a squeal or even the creaking of branches. Her heart began to pound with fear. The tall ghost was stalking her in the woods, the one without eyes. She was alone in the woods, far from the abbey, far from help. Doubts began to flicker to life in her mind. She had expected to confront it, but she was so far from everyone. So far from help. Why had the mysteries led her to this place? She touched one of the lumbering branches with her hand, feeling the jagged edges of the bark. From the wood, she felt music begin to stir. Tingles shot down her arm. Something about this tree seemed familiar. She had been here before, not above, flying over, but here. In this exact location. Her memories did not go back that far, but she was certain of it. She had been here. Maybe it was a dream she couldn't remember. The silence in the woods became absolute. She couldn't even hear her own breathing. The tall ghost entered the grove from behind her. She began to tremble as she sensed it, reliving the terrors of her childhood. "No, not a ghost," she reminded herself. It was a myriad one, and it had tormented her for what felt like forever.
"You came at last. I knew you would come."
She felt a shudder ripple through her as it approached her from behind. Her mind went black with terror. All the memories of her childhood came flooding back to her. She felt like that little girl again. Overcome by terror and helplessness, she was nothing. She was insignificant. No one loved her or cared for her. There was nothing but utter loneliness.
"You seek the secrets of your past. You wish to know who and what you are. You are your father's daughter. You are bound to us, child of dark. You were born in sin. You will rule us all. You are Ereshkigal incarnate."
Suddenly, Seti's arms and legs began to tremble and convulse. She couldn't control them. She sagged down to her knees as if a huge weight had begun to crush her. The fear brought on by her memories and the present threat combined to drown her. Her voice was locked away, seized and broken. Breathing was impossible. This feeling was so much more potent than what she'd experienced with the false version of Mrs. Pullman. It was 100 times worse. Had she been brought there to die?
"You must become her, child. You were born to quit the light. Every king and queen, every empress and duke will bow the knee to you, child of the fells. Remove it. Remove it. Remove it."
The urge to rip away the chain was overpowering as the myriad one's thoughts hammered against her mind. Why had she come here? Why had she thought she could defeat a being so full of hate? One older than the world. She was nothing but a helpless little girl. She'd never had any power over this hateful thing, and she never would. "Help me," she pleaded silently in her mind. She could sense the frail thread of her faith, and she clung to it.
I don't want to be trapped in the darkness. Help me.
You plead to it?
The dark being mocked her. Soon it would be close enough to touch her, and then she knew she would be lost.
You whine and beg. Stand and act. It is your destiny to rule over worlds. Claim it. Your true father calls to you. Come to him. Join with us.
Help me,
Seti pleaded again, trying to banish the dark thoughts from her mind. A light pierced the grove, blinding her. It was the sun, breaching the maze of limbs at last. Seti raised her hand to it as if she could grasp it and pull it. She felt a power surge inside of her.
No, no, she is mine. She is mine.
Strength filled her body as she looked up, feeling the light bathe her face. It was too bright to see, and she had to shield her eyes from it.
No.
She could control her thoughts again.
Apocalyptus, she thought.
The word of power seized a hold of the tall one, making it hunch over and twist in contortions. She felt its intense agony as it was forced to reveal itself.
I am Istvar the Fallen.
It had spoken its true name. That gave her power over it. She felt waves of hatred billowing from the being. It filled her heart with darkness. The pain of Seti's past began to shed from her. She wasn't a child anymore. She wasn't an unloved waif in the fells. No one could force her to do anything she didn't want to do. The choice was hers. Always hers. Seti straightened herself, feeling the glow of light suffuse her. Somehow touching the tree had lent her strength. There was power in the tree, a strange power, and its music sang to her.
Banir expiare,
she thought to it, rebuking the creature, sending it away. A wind rushed and shook through the woods. The earth trembled. There was a clash of thunder somewhere in the distance. Seti steadied herself against the oak, her knees knocking together, and she felt part of the great tree open. The music of the mysteries filled the air in triumph, almost loud enough to drown out the myriad one's shrieks as the tree swallowed it whole. The rush of power ended, and Seti felt as if she had climbed the tallest mountain and run out of air. She collapsed, suddenly overcome with weakness. The noises from the woods returned as she lay, panting, breathless. To move a muscle would have required more energy than she possessed. There were crackling noises, the sound of shoes. Still, she couldn't move. She was falling asleep, exhausted beyond her mortal strength. Someone knelt and crouched by her from behind, causing the dry oak leaves to crackle. She could smell onions. A heavy hand grazed her head. As she sank into a hole, the sounds around her growing fainter and fainter, she just barely heard a throaty, thickly accented voice say,
I bestow on you the gift of...
Foremost, the test marks a change in them forever. But that change can be for good or ill. It promises protection from the unseen evils of this land, but it also brings to sharper focus our differences with the rest of the fallen world. It invites persecution and mockery from other worlds that rival ours. Those who cannot endure the light of reason and knowledge are more comfortable living in the darkness of superstition. Light reveals, darkness conceals. how quick we are to disbelieve what will hurt our view of ourselves. People, whatever their circumstances, struggle with being petty and jealous by nature. We are all, to some extent, selfish and self-absorbed. The test tries to lift us above it. For some, it only makes it worse. Hence the ancient wisdom of days long past. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow.
Thomas Abraham, Aldermaston of Mirwood Abbey. Sarah. Chapter 31. The Below. Sarah kept glancing over her shoulder, expecting to see Will pursuing her down the dark street. She had stopped running only because she was so winded, and each gasp felt like it wouldn't be enough to sate her hunger for air. Where was he? Her ankles and heels throbbed painfully because her shoes were not designed for such hard walking or running. Passing under the glare of a light leering, she quickly altered course to plunge back into the shadows.
Sarah!
It was him. Her heart trembled in panic. Would he wrestle her back to the house? He was stronger than her. She hated the situation she was trapped in, hated that she'd trusted the wrong people. The night air was cold, and mist wreathed the rooftops. Walking in the shadows, she felt frightened and determined and sick to her stomach. Shelter. She needed shelter soon. But where? Turning another corner, which opened to a wider street, she saw carriages pulled by horses. It amazed her to see them, a sight she'd only seen depicted in gazettes. But the amazement withered when she saw there were steaming piles of manure in the road as well. More lights lit the way, and the street opened to shop fronts with soot-smudged windows, revealing an assortment of bakeries, milliner shops, and confectionaries. Each already closed, the insides darkened. Lights came from the windows above the shops where the owners had retired. There were others walking around, so at least she wasn't alone.
Sarah!
The sound was getting closer. Her sense of vulnerability was growing by the moment. She didn't know where she was in the city. Were there street gangs here like the ones Seti had told her about in the Fells? Would some youth try to rob her, even though she had no money? Mr. Durant. He lived in the city. If she could find out where, she could perhaps get a message to him, or have someone take her to him.
Are you lost, miss?
Said a man, deliberately blocking her way. He smiled at her, but there was something in his grinning expression that troubled her. He held a hand up in a friendly way, but she stopped and retreated. No, thank you, she said, moving around him.
I can help, miss. Let me help you find your way.
His excessive zeal made her even more distrusting. Suddenly, light from a zephyr streaked overhead, catching their attention. It was a military craft, and it was heading the way she had come. This was the evidence, had she needed it, that Lord Wells had played her for a fool. He'd brought Commander Falking and his letter straight to her in Mirwood. Perhaps he'd even played a role in the unfolding conflict with King Fountain. He'd certainly seemed less than diplomatic in his dealings with the foreign prince the day of the Privy Council meeting. What better way to ensure his own power than to pursue a war that would elevate him to his former position? And who better to arrange for one than her own father? The gears in the machine were turning even now, and perhaps she had caught on too late to stop them. Well, if Wells was involved, she wouldn't make it easy on him. Taking advantage of the distraction the zephyr brought, Sarah slipped around the man and hurried down the street, ignoring the throbbing in her legs. Where could she go? How could she hope to find Mr. Durant in this foreign place? The noise of hooves coming fast behind her frightened her, and she lunged out of the way as another carriage roared past. The driver shouted a reprimand at her, and as she reeled with the reprieve from danger, she stepped into one of the piles of filth. It was disgusting, and she stamped her foot to dislodge the mushy, odorous cakes. Looking back, she saw Will coming down the street, looking from side to side. He was still searching for her, and if he caught up with her, all would be lost. All might already be lost. She had to get off the street quickly. Ahead, she saw a row of houses with steep steps leading up to the doors. They were tall and thin, like the one she had just left, and there were lights shining within. She hurried to the first one and mounted the steps. The hair on the back of her neck was standing up, and a shiver went through her. She ignored the sensation. There was no time to seek out another doorway, and knocked several times. There was the turning of several locks, and then the door opened, and a butler stood in the crack, eyeing her suspiciously.
"What do you want?"
he asked sternly.
"Please help me,"
she said, glancing back down the street. Will was getting closer.
"Can I speak to the master of the—"
The butler shut the door with a resounding thud, and he locked it up again. Angry, she fled down the steps and didn't bother with the other houses. There was darkness ahead, and she hoped to slip into an alley and wait for him to pass by before she went the other way. How could she have gotten herself into such a predicament? When she reached the darkness, where there weren't any street lamps, the houses were shabbier. This was a seedier neighborhood. But if she attempted to turn around, there would be no avoiding Will. Then she saw the kirkyard just ahead. The gate was shut, but the bars were quite wide. Could she squeeze through them? She increased her pace, intent on trying. Weeds grew in the seams of the cobblestones. There was a small church beyond the kirkyard, and it was also darkened. Sarah stepped through the bars and struggled through the opening because it was too narrow. She clenched her jaw and wriggled, trying to get through the cold, wet bars that were making a mess of her gown. The sound of Will's boots echoed on the street. Closer, closer. Still, she wasn't fitting. Screwing up her determination, she twisted and squirmed, crushing her breasts in the process, but she made it through with relief, grateful that her small stature had finally proven useful. There wasn't a moment to spare. Stealthily, she crept to a larger headstone and then crouched behind it and held her breath, afraid Will might have heard or seen her. A few moments later, she saw him walk by the gate. He stopped at it, gazing into the kirkyard. She ducked but couldn't see his face through the shadows. She heard him shake the bars, saw his face twisted with anger. But then he proceeded down the street, muttering under his breath. Sarah rested her forehead on the stone and trembled with cold. Then she turned and sat down, leaning her back against it, wrapping her arms around her knees. Her mother was probably frantic. Her father was undoubtedly gleeful at her mistake. There was a good chance he had helped orchestrate it. Tears pricked her eyes, and she brushed them away angrily. Now was not the time to cry about her misfortune. Now was the time for action. The air felt so much colder than before. Her legs were aching. How had she bungled things so badly? All her feelings of self-doubt came bubbling like water in a kettle. Who was she to think she could save the people of this world from their misery? Why should she even try? She bit her lip, feeling so sorry for herself. Her reputation would be ruined forever over this one mistake. The people would be horribly disappointed in her. She was disappointed in herself. Why go back to Lockhaven at all? Why face the shame? No matter how she tried to defend herself, people would only believe the worst. People would want to believe the worst. It would give them something to titter about over their afternoon tea. Those same young ladies from the gathering at Pavenham Sky would cluck their tongues and comment on her lack of character. Of course a young woman so sympathetic to the plight of the poor would make such an error of judgment. Sarah's anguish grew deeper and deeper. When had she ever felt so miserable? Why did she keep making mistakes? It would have been better if she'd never been born. The thought struck a chill in her heart. Coldness seeped inside her. There was a strange, twisted logic to her thought. What if she never returned? She could go back to the street, and when a carriage roared past, she could step in front of it. What a tragic end to the tale. Something sweet and delicious came with the image of her parents finding her crushed body. Then Will would mourn what he had done to her. He'd grieve the rest of his life. A hint of satisfaction bloomed. Yes, wouldn't that be a way to get... It terrified her when she realized what she had been contemplating. She shook her head and blinked quickly. Her thoughts had completely run away from her. Why couldn't she ever rein them in? A queer feeling had come over her. It confused and sickened her. Looking around, back pressed against the stone, she saw a small candle glowing from the window of the church. She hadn't noticed any light before. From the way it wavered and flickered, she knew it couldn't be a leering. Slowly, Sarah rose from her hiding spot. A carriage rattled in the distance, and the yearning to seek it out became overwhelming. But so did her curiosity about the candle. It seemed to be moving toward her. She took a few hesitant steps closer, and then she heard footsteps from the church. The door opened, and a man stood beneath the awning holding a candle. He was not an aged old thing, probably a man in his 30s. The vicar?
Is someone there?
He asked in a wary voice, raising the candle higher. Sarah stepped into its circle of light. His eyes widened with surprise and a little fear.
Can you help me, Vicar? She asked.
The vicar went home, he said hesitantly. I'm the groundskeeper. What do you want? I don't have any money to give you. I locked the gate earlier. How did you get in?
I squeezed through the bars, she answered, wringing her hands. I was attacked by a man, a soldier. He's looking for me right now. I need to hide.
Are you alone?
He asked, raising the candle higher and gazing around her. He looked doubtful of what he should do.
Yes, she answered. Please, sir, can you help me?
He sniffed and wiped his nose on his arm. A scowl showed he was not thrilled with the idea.
You really shouldn't stay here, lass. It's a kirkyard.
Yes, I know, but I need help. If you would...
No, lass, you don't understand. I just buried 10 folk today, 2 families. All of them died of the cholera morbus. You really shouldn't come near me. Don't know if I caught it, too.
He sniffed again, looking weary and fearful. And she had been nestled in the ground behind a grave marker. Her insides twisted at the dilemma she was in. Now it was even worse.
I'm sorry for disturbing you,
she said miserably. She turned to leave.
Wait,
he called after. She hesitated.
Let me unlock it for you.
She nodded, and he shuffled down the steps of the church, candle in hand. He sniffed and wiped his nose again on his arm. When he reached the gate, he withdrew a key from his pocket and fitted into the lock.
There's lots who's died this time, he said in a melancholy way. But I hear it's fewer and fewer cases these days. Many on this street fled to the north when it struck. Haven't been here in weeks. Folks die, he said, grunting as he jiggled the key in the lock. Are buried, then more die. Then like a fever breaking, it's over for a time. No one knows how it starts or when it'll end.
He pulled on the gate, and it squeaked as it opened.
My job is digging graves, he sniffed. It's work. I'm luckier than many.
Thank you, she said, giving him a nod.
Do you have any parents, lass? Anyone you want me to send for?
He asked, hand resting on the bar.
You look awful young to be walking the streets. Awful young.
Then she realized that her appearance and story had given him the wrong impression.
I have an uncle, she said. He's an advocate. He would come get me.
What's his name? Where does he live? The city is an awful big place.
I don't know where he lives. I don't even know where I am. But his name is Mr. Durant.
Durant, said the groundskeeper with a whistle. The famous one? The one who helps the Prince Regent's daughter? He's your uncle?
You know him? Sarah asked, hope beginning to stir.
Everyone down here knows him.
His countenance changed dramatically, turning much more cheerful.
Here, why don't you come with me to Billaby's pub? It's warmer there, and it's a friendly crowd. I know old Billaby. He'll send for your uncle. How's that?
Sarah smiled at him broadly.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough.
It was nearly midnight when Mr. Durant arrived at the public house. Some of the patrons were still sipping the dregs of their drinks, and there was a strong yeasty smell in the air. But a fire crackled in the hearth, a real one, fed by wood, not by a leering. The men in the tavern were a rough crowd, and more kept coming in by the hour to spend the humid night. The owner of the pub, Mr. Billaby, greeted each by name and offered them mead or beer or wine, depending on their preference. Sarah sat at a table, and her new friend, Mr. Krant, sat across from her with a mug of his own. No one else had sat near them. Apparently, being a gravedigger wasn't exactly a noble profession. But Billaby took his coins anyway. Mr. Durant arrived in a black cloak and hat, and when he saw Sarah sitting at the table, he nearly lost all his composure. He tucked his hat in the crook of his arm and then hurried toward the table.
Mr. Krant,
he said to the gravedigger, reaching out and gripping the man's bare hand with his own gloved one. He pumped it vigorously.
Thank you for summoning me to find my niece,
he gave Sarah a scolding frown.
We will talk later, young lady. I brought a carriage. Thank you, sir. If you are ever in need of services from the law, you know how to find me. Thank you. It's no trouble, Mr. Durant. Your niece Sarah is a nice lass. Probably fell in with the wrong crowd. It happens more often than it should, unfortunately. The wrong crowd, indeed, replied the advocate with a hint of irony. Well, your efforts tonight are appreciated. Come, niece.
He bowed his head to the gravedigger, and Sarah rose from the table.
Thank you for helping me, Mr. Krant. I won't forget it.
She gave him a kindly smile, knowing that she would see to it that he never had to dig graves again, if he'd managed to avoid the outbreak.
Good night, miss. Best to you both.
Sarah followed Durant out of the pub to the carriage stationed in front of it. A pair of sturdy horses stamped and nickered, and the driver held his whip, ready to go. Durant opened the carriage door, and Sarah climbed the small steps to the sheltered cab. A zephyr flew overhead, shining its light down on the street, and she stared up at it for a long moment. Was it another ship from the Ministry of War, looking for her?
Quickly,
Durant urged, and she hurriedly entered. Taking a seat on the cushion, she breathed a sigh of relief. Durant closed the door, seated himself, and then tapped the roof with his cane. He leaned back in the seat, his features haggard and defeated. The look he gave her was full of disappointment. Sarah's relief wilted.
How bad is it?
Sarah asked him, bracing herself to hear his words.
Tell me that you gave the letters from Lady Corinne to somebody. Anybody. Who has them?
Sarah's stomach dropped.
They're still in my room. I was going to show them to Fitzroy, but I never had the chance.
He closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose with his fingers. The carriage jumbled and rattled down the street. He looked as if he were suffering from an intense internal pain.
Never had the chance,
he sighed. Then he shook his head, gazing out the window, looking anywhere but at her eyes. Disappointment was etched into the lines of his face. She could feel it coming off him in waves.
Tell me,
she asked meekly. He was silent, composing himself as if he didn't trust himself to speak. But he finally did, and his words tortured her.
You went out tonight with your governess, a woman who has likely betrayed you, to visit a young man who, I've come to find out, has a reputation for seducing the fairer sex. Lord Wells was very concerned to learn from his commander that you'd left your mother's house to meet one of his soldiers. I learned several hours ago that you had disappeared, that you were probably having a little chat with your old flame in an abandoned house. I was notified by your mother. She thought you'd been kidnapped. The search going on right now, I've never seen the likes of it. Other than those who arranged it, everyone is afraid you've been abducted. But the truth, when it comes out, and it will bring you down. Will bring us both down. No doubt they searched your room first and found the letters. Sarah, it will look as if you and I were scheming to upstage your father. I knew about the letters. I cannot deny it in front of an oath leering. My dear, the cause is lost. There is no way the Privy Council will choose you now. None whatsoever. It's all ruined.
His face contorted into anger. He still wouldn't look at her. She saw his clenched fists tremble in his lap. He had tied his future to hers, and it led nowhere. The carriage pulled to a sudden stop, and the driver called out,
"What is it, officers?"
Mr. Durant closed his eyes, leaning his head back against the headrest in despair. Sarah saw a light shine in through the window, blinding her.
"We're looking for—"
The man abruptly cut off his words.
"Captain! Captain! She's in here!"
Chapter 32 The Rising. Sarah's first foray to the world below had ended in an unmitigated disaster. It was a scandal. There was no other suitable word to describe the situation Sarah found herself in when she returned to Lockhaven with a military escort. What troubled her the most were the looks of disappointment on everyone's faces. She had earned such looks from her parents when she was younger. Now everyone, including Mr. Durant, looked at her as if they were terribly disappointed. She was brought back to the palace before dawn, but wasn't permitted to speak to the Privy Council. Mr. Durant tried to insist on it, to exercise her rights as a princess, but he was met with a stone-cold reproof, and the two of them were ordered to wait in a sitting room while the council met. Durant had slumped into a stuffed chair and rubbed his eyes, for he had not slept most of the night. Sarah paced in the room, glancing occasionally out the window to track the rising of the sun. Each hour they were made to wait was a new kind of torture. The suspense of not knowing what would happen to her made her imagination run rampant. She was already experiencing the effects of the shunning. When the servants entered with the morning meal, they wouldn't meet her gaze or speak. Not a word. The tinkling of the silverware became deafening in the silence. "At least have some potatoes, Mr. Durant," Sarah attempted in a light-hearted note. He looked as if he had aged 10 years overnight.
"I've quite lost my appetite," he said in a surly voice.
Sarah had as well. The slices of fruit on the tray looked somewhat appetizing, but her stomach squirmed at the mere thought of food. No, she continued to pace, wondering how long the Privy Council would protract the torture. "They haven't even asked to hear my side," Sarah said forlornly. "I was duped, but I'm not wicked. Where is Hugild?" Mr. Durant's eyes were narrowed with misery.
"Who knows? Probably on a zephyr far, far away with enough money in the bank to live comfortably for years. You were alone with a young man, Sarah. You were locked in a room with him. That alone may brand you for the rest of your life. Some of the ladies on the Privy Council were aghast at what you'd done. What you risked to reclaim letters. They thought the contents must be very bad indeed. And you'll not be surprised to hear the letters themselves have disappeared."
His lip twitched.
"You should have reached out to me. You should have confided in me. I was your advocate, Sarah. 4 years I've spent. Wasted. Instead, you put your faith in a woman your estranged father had appointed to you."
His words stung her heart. It was shortly after sunrise that a knock sounded on the door. Lord Fitzroy entered. Her insides coiled into knots, and she stopped her pacing, seeking his eyes. He looked tired, but not accusatory. The corner of his mouth quirked into a little smile of familiarity.
"Please, Lord Fitzroy.
Out with it," Sarah pleaded.
"Don't spare me the worst."
"Miss Fitzempress,"
Mr. Durant chided, rising from his chair for the first time.
"Let him speak." "You bear grave news, Minister. I see it in your countenance."
Fitzroy shut the door behind him and wandered over to the trays of food.
"Our forces at Grishok were attacked. The war has started."
He said this as he gazed at the cantaloupe and the orange slices.
"Grishok,"
Durant whispered in shock.
"That's a coastal fortress." "It's not a fortress anymore,"
Fitzroy said, looking at the advocate.
"It's been reduced to rubble. King Fountain has won the first skirmish. They have power we do not yet understand. Power to smash stone. The reports are still coming in. Part of the fleet was deployed to defend Grishok. They say the enemy ships came out of the water without warning and launched some sort of fiery missiles at the fortress. One of the hurricanes was damaged when it dropped low to counterattack, and it had to retreat higher to the clouds to avoid foundering."
He sighed.
"So we are at war with King Fountain."
He gazed at her.
"You can imagine what the Privy Council has decided in consequence."
Sarah bit her lip, her heart full of anguish for the fallen soldiers. Yes, she knew. There wasn't another choice.
"The decision has been made, then?"
Fitzroy nodded slowly.
"It has. The Privy Council has chosen your father as the new emperor. It is a pragmatic choice under the circumstances."
Mr. Durant stifled a groan, and Fitzroy shot him an angry look. Sarah felt a spasm of pain at the words. Her hopes had all crashed to the ground, broken to pieces like the fortress of Grishok.
"Did anyone speak for me?"
Sarah asked huskily, trying not to cry.
"Was I condemned without knowledge of all the facts? I was duped, Lord Fitzroy."
Fitzroy turned and faced her, his hands behind his back.
"I spoke for you, Sarah,"
he said compassionately.
"Even though I sensed the momentum of the situation was against you. Even though I knew it would be unpopular for me to speak in favor of you. But then, I've never much cared for others' opinions of me."
Mr. Durant approached, his face angry.
"Were you the only one who spoke for her? Was everyone else too cowardly?"
There was a glint of answering anger in Fitzroy's eyes.
"Mr. Durant, have a care. Are you so caught up in your own feelings that you cannot appreciate what Sarah is suffering?" "What she is suffering?"
Durant said, aghast.
"I've given 4 years,"
Fitzroy interrupted.
"You speculated, like many others, that she would gain the throne. No doubt your losses are great. But they are not greater than hers. She had no money at play here, only her future."
Sarah turned and looked at Mr. Durant.
You speculated about me?"
"Everyone has,"
he shot back.
"It was always a long shot. But it is in those risks that great fortunes are won or lost."
His voice was like a growl. Sarah put her hand on her heart.
How many people had lost money because of her failure? It was obvious the depth of people's feelings toward her had been motivated by greed, not only her plans for the empire. She was like a racehorse who had foundered on the track. The thought disgusted her.
"Lady Corinne was behind this," Sarah said angrily. "She and Wells were behind it, like spiders. She gave me the letters, and I, like a fool, let them harm me."
"The letters you reference,"
Fitzroy asked for clarification,
"are the ones found in your room?"
"Yes, the ones my father wrote to Lady Corinne."
Fitzroy's lips pursed.
"They were unopened, if I understand things properly. They were given to the Emperor after they were discovered in your room. I was told they were forgeries, written by a hand that only resembles your father's.
He claims it was an attempt by you to blackmail him.
That isn't true, Sarah countered. Lady Corinne gave them to me secretly when I visited Pavenham Sky. She asked me to return them to my father and to insist that he not send any more. She wouldn't read them because they didn't go through her husband.
Spiders. Just as she'd thought, and she'd stumbled into their web without realizing it.
Is that why you believe she orchestrated these events? Fitzroy asked. Such a serious accusation requires proof. She was named a member of the Privy Council last night. Lady Corinne?
Durant gasped in surprise.
Indeed,
Fitzroy said.
Her husband has been called back to military duty, as have I. I'll be returning to Meerwood shortly to bid farewell to my family before taking my command.
But you're the Minister of Wind, Sarah said in surprise.
Not any longer,
he answered.
Lord Wells was named Prime Minister by your father in the meeting. Lord Prentice was forced to step down and has returned to his old post as Minister of Wind. Everything else remains as it was, with one exception. Lady Corinne has joined the council. If you have any further information, Sarah, I should like to know. I thought her above such blatant political scheming, but when such power is up for grabs, people will stoop low to snatch it.
Of course. They'd gotten everything they wanted. Power, prestige, a war to distract the people from the cholera morbus, from poverty, from the divisions in their society, and presumably Lady Corinne's husband had made a neat bundle from speculating on it all. The people would suffer for this. Sarah clenched her fists, but her resolve began to founder. If I had become Empress, she would no longer have as much power. She controls fashion, she controls who is ostracized. She regretted saying it, remembering that Fitzroy's wife had once been shunned by the lady. If he was bothered by her comment, he didn't show it.
That is all probably true, Sarah. She would have lost some of her influence. Unfortunately, it won't be enough to convince anyone that she was scheming against you.
He sighed.
A very good friend of mine lost his estate, Gimmerton Sow, because of the machinations of the Lawton family. Now that he has prospered running my mines, he would like to buy the property back. But Admiral Lawton has refused to sell it. It's not about money. The Lawtons don't want my friend to get his estate back, even though it's still unoccupied. They consider him undeserving of his former position in society, simply because they decided it was so.
Seti had told her the story of the family's fall from grace. She'd felt the floating manor quake beneath her. I don't have any firm evidence, she admitted. Just the suspicions I've shared with you.
Best to keep those to yourself, he replied with a warning tone. It would be fair to say that the Lawtons betted against you becoming Empress. You are correct. They had reason to support your father as Emperor. The incident last night made you lose favor with the Council, for now. I'm hoping it's not lost forever, but it will take time. Trust is easily broken, like a mirror. You cannot repair the cracks. It must be made over.
Sarah nodded, feeling her shame flare up again. I will do what I can to make amends. Just so you know, I didn't... Fitzroy held up a hand, forestalling her.
You don't need to tell me anything, Sarah. I'm on your side still, whatever happened. And those who are your true friends always will be.
He gave Durant a pointed look as he said this. Sarah sighed in relief. Thank you, Lord Fitzroy. I'm sick inside that I was so foolish. What will I do now that Father is Emperor? Can I go to Meerwood to take the test?
Yes, what is to be done?
Durant asked. He looked beaten down by Fitzroy's rebukes.
I was not the only one who spoke up for you during the council,
Fitzroy said.
While the Minister of Thought did vote for your father, he encouraged us all to be understanding of the foibles of youth, that we tend to be too severe. He said, and I will always remember this, that if the knowing desired to put a 40-year-old's head on a 16-year-old's shoulders, it would have done so. Instead, the knowing put a 16-year-old's head on a 16-year-old's shoulders, and we should all try to be more understanding. Sometimes we measure someone from the position of our own years and experience. We forget what it is like to be young. You made a mistake, Sarah. What happened in that room will be speculated about, gossiped about. Only you and that young man know the facts, and we can assume he was paid to embellish the incident. Perhaps it's not as serious as the rumors suggest, but it was still an unfortunate error in judgment. And when you lead people, when lives are at stake based on the decisions you make, the people must be able to trust you. To trust, too, that you can learn from your mistakes. This is your opportunity, Sarah, to prove that you can.
She nodded vigorously. I will do my best, Lord Fitzroy. So I am to go back to Mirwood, then? To spend another year as a learner? The test was yesterday, was it not?
He shook his head, and her stomach plummeted.
What, then? She asked worriedly.
She'll be put in a wardship,
Durant surmised. He clapped his hands together, his eyes intent.
Who? You? I did request it,
Fitzroy said, but the resignation in his voice told her that he had not been granted his desire.
I think I see where this is going,
Durant said in despair. Fitzroy nodded.
You will not be permitted to take the test yet. Your father has asked the Lawtons to oversee the remainder of your education at Pavenham Sky, as a personal favor to him. I don't think Seti would be permitted to go there. Your mother will be given the right to visit on a schedule.
Sarah's eyes widened with surprise and shock. Pavenham Sky?
And what's to become of me?
Mr. Durant asked in desperation.
Your services are no longer required,
Fitzroy said flatly.
The Emperor has banned you from returning to Lockhaven. With the Privy Council's decision, Sarah is no longer in need of your services.
But what about the test?
Sarah asked in desperation.
You will be permitted to take it later, when the Privy Council feels that sufficient time has passed. I'm sorry, Sarah. That is the will of the Council.
She lowered her head and felt the burning tears at last. Chapter 33 Wars of Religion. The days began to blur together for Sarah as she prepared to depart for Pavenham Sky immediately following her father's coronation ceremony. The decorations in the palace were transforming it into some sort of fairyland of opulence. She hardly recognized the corridors or the mobs of servants working from before sunrise until well after sunset. In all her dreams of becoming empress, she would never have imagined spending a fortune on the ceremony itself. Not when they were now at war. Not when there were people starving down below. She had seen the people's hunger, their resentment against those who lived in the clouds above them. She'd seen a glimpse of the true disease infecting her empire. The palace kitchens never stopped working to feed the hosts of nobles assembling from their sky manors throughout the realm. Dignitaries arrived from distant shores to witness the event, and she was forbidden to meet any of them. For the most part, she was sequestered with two maids, both chosen by her father to keep watch on her. Neither girl attempted to befriend her. They seemed sullen and resentful that they were forced to be her chaperones. News of the war with King Fountain was slow to reach her. She'd always relied on Mr. Durant to supply news and gossip. But now he was gone for good, ripped from her life. Mother was given permission to visit with her for just an hour each day. She bore a portion of blame for Sarah's indiscretion. But if she were to be accepted as the Emperor's consort, she had to acquiesce to his demands. Their marriage, everyone knew, was still a sham. But during a time of war, it was important to project the illusion of unity. Sarah found it all rather sickening. Her belongings were packed and ready to be loaded. She wore a ceremonial dress, too ostentatious for her tastes, but it had been provided for her, and she had been given no choice but to wear it. Her hair was coiffed, and her nails buffed and decorated. She would look like a princess, even though she wasn't permitted to attend the celebratory events following the coronation. Basically, she was a prisoner of the court. A knock sounded on the door, and Sarah instinctively braced herself for the visitor. Rather than the underling she expected, it was Mr. Case, her father's secretary. She despised the man, but she rose from her chair and greeted him with false affection.
"The Emperor will see you now," he said, bowing to her.
Getting an audience with her father was a rarity, and it unnerved her. What demands would he make of her now? Was another privilege to be stripped away from her? What more could father take from her? They were at war with a rival world, a world that shared some common beliefs but had very different traditions. A war in the name of religion. It filled Sarah with foreboding. She followed Mr. Case as he led the way to her father's private chambers. Again, the transformation of the corridor required them to move cautiously. The flowered garlands practically rained petals down on them, and there were servants with brooms and trays to sweep up the remains. The clamor of the workers made it difficult to hear. When they arrived, the guards at the chamber parted and the door opened. Her father sat at his breakfast table, the Gazette at his elbow. He was chewing vigorously, though his appetite did not curb his animated conversation with Lady Corinne, seated near him. Sarah recognized the butler of Pavenham Sky, Master Sewell, standing in attendance at a discreet distance.
"What of the Collar Morbus?" Lady Corinne asked. There were remains of a meal on her plate.
So, they had breakfasted together. Never had Sarah felt more certain she'd been duped.
"Ah, yes," Father said after clearing his mouth. "The doctors report that fewer cases are inflicting the city, fewer corpses to bury. It seems that the fire has burnt out for the time being. There are certain quarters of the city that were abandoned after it struck. People fled to the countryside, those who could afford to at any rate. Some households were wiped out. Overall, the toll seems to be around 20,000.
He shrugged.
"It's not as bad as it could have been."
"That's a relief," Lady Corinne said. She glanced over at Sarah, her eyes revealing nothing of her emotions, neither satisfaction nor disdain.
"And isn't it fortunate, my lord, that the outbreak has ended on the eve of your coronation?"
Father positively glowed at her attention. He wiped his hands on the silk napkin and dabbed some grease from his chin.
"It is indeed," he said with real pleasure. "A sign from the mysteries, I should think. The doctors were never able to determine the cause of it. But the current theory is the noxious miasma that persists down below. They have encouraged people to walk about with handkerchiefs covering their mouths. I've seen it through the leerings."
He wagged his own handkerchief at her playfully and then set it down. Sarah stared at the two of them, feeling anger start to ignite the blood in her veins. Whenever her parents breakfasted together, they always sat opposite each other, their mutual loathing obvious. Here was Lady Corinne sitting at Father's elbow, having a private conversation with him as he strutted like a peacock in front of her. As he mocked his own sick and dying people. Father turned and his look cooled immediately.
"I said to bring her after breakfast, Case,"
he snapped petulantly. Mr. Case looked mortified.
"I'm sorry, Your Majesty."
Sarah could see that Mr. Case didn't even try to defend himself. His job was to weather Father's moods.
"Well, she is here at any rate."
He coughed into his hand and then leaned back in the plush cushions of his chair. His look was that of a cat grown fat on cream. He lazily rubbed his finger around the goblet and then brought the cup to his mouth and took a sip.
"You will be departing after the ceremony to Pavenham Sky with Master Sewell,"
he said firmly.
"He will see that you are situated as do your station."
There was something in his voice that warned her, chilled her.
"Lady Corinne is part of the Privy Council now and will return to the manor following the next council meeting."
He dipped his head to Lady Corinne respectfully.
The lady's expression did not change, but she looked at Sarah coolly, gloved hands clasped on her lap.
"I already knew that, Father," Sarah said, struggling to maintain her temper. He still flinched subtly when she used that name for him. There was still a part of him that didn't believe she was his offspring. And following her disgrace and his ascension, he had little need to acknowledge her. The familiarity between Corinne and himself revealed much. Sarah knew that Lady Corinne had no children of her own, and the lady was quite a bit younger than her husband. Who would inherit Pavenham Sky? Maybe she planned for it all to come to her. Maybe she had her sights set on replacing Sarah's mother.
"Of course you knew it," Father said peevishly. "But that's not why I summoned you. I wanted to share other news with you myself."
Sarah swallowed, feeling the room tighten in around her.
"What news?"
"Be silent, and I shall tell you. You've heard of the skirmish of Grishok, no doubt. Yes, I see that you have. There was another battle fought yesterday at a mirror gate off the coast of Dahomey. Do you know what a gate—"
"They are the portals between our worlds," Sarah interrupted. "How we have made trade possible with other worlds."
She knew this from her studies at Mirwood. The portals were made of natural arches, stones that had worn away, leaving a hollow space within. Leerings were carved into them, which connected them to natural arches in other worlds. Some portals were formed by the erosion at sea. Some were made from rivers and canyons. Once they toppled, they could no longer be used. And depending on the size, ships could even be sent through them. They were rare and took thousands of years to form.
"Yes, well, the one at the shore of Dahomey was attacked. We have ships stationed at every one now, and we were prepared for the fight. It was a vicious battle, and our forces had to retreat. We lost a hurricane and 12 tempests in the fighting. They had an armada of sorts. Vicious fighting, as I said. There were many casualties. Many gave their lives trying to defend the Empire."
His eyes glittered as he said this. For some reason, he was savoring it. He still hadn't revealed his purpose.
"That's awful," Sarah said, her stomach churning.
"The carnage was immense," Father said. "They used some strange new weaponry, exploding balls that wreak havoc on our hulls. They have lots of smoke, make it difficult for our dragoons to find targets. Messy business. One exploded into the hull of the hurricane, and the bits of metal cut into the young men stationed there. Many fell to their deaths because they weren't roped in."
He folded his hands in front of him.
"Including one Lieutenant Russell."
Sarah was horrified. Not just at the news, but at the vindictive way her father had decided to reveal it to her. Her feelings for Will had certainly changed since his betrayal. Her memories and fancies had altered irrevocably. But she hadn't wanted him to die, and the thought of him plummeting from a broken skyship after being lacerated by an explosion made her tremble with sadness and regret. She would never see him again. He would never have the chance to gain the type of wisdom that only came with age, to right the wrongs he had done. His life had been snuffed out among so many others. Grief and anguish flooded her. War. Bloody and final. And it was just beginning. It was no cause for celebration. For speculation. Lives were on the line.
"That young man can tarnish you no more," Father said coldly.
Did you send him to his death?" Sarah said with a trembling voice.
"Did I know that Dahomey would be attacked? Of course not. I'm no harbinger. I sent him far away so that you wouldn't be tempted by his ignoble blood any further. You shamed yourself, Sarah. I would be angrier if it had not yielded the fruit I desired to taste. You are young and naive, which the Council took into consideration. I hope that you will learn from your mistakes. Always you were a headstrong girl, but perhaps shame will teach you prudence. As a personal favor to me, Lady Corinne has agreed to take you in as her ward.
You've much to learn about the ways of society and the proper boundaries. I hope you will learn from her and adopt all that she teaches you. One day, if you prove faithful to me, you may yet be chosen.